Now recording.
Hello and welcome to recording number 23 of Gary Gygax's Sea of Death, an annotated reading. Today is September 27th, 2021. In the previous recording, we saw Gord and Lita making their way up to the center temple and then seeing fighting going back and forth. So it appeared that Eclavdra and Obmi had made it to the city out of mind at the same time. Then it detailed a little bit of Obmi fighting his way through joyously through the soul pygmies. And I believe you also maybe saw some of Eclavdra's work going on too. But we left Obmi, and it's page 265, paragraph 2. As Obmi came to an intersection of two avenues and turned the corner, he first peered ahead and caught sight of a commotion taking place in the distance. "Blast," he roared. "Could it be that the filthy drow yet survives?" Holt, as mystified as his master, was angry, wisely let the question pass. Obmi stood still, taking a few seconds to discern the path along which the distant activity was moving, then let his gaze continue to track along the same route. Suddenly he set his eyes upon an imposing building a few hundred yards away. There he bellowed to the remainder of his assault group, "Look, you dogs, the temple lies ahead, and we must get there first. Run over any who stand in your way. Now, and move for that place." Gord and Lita had come into the pygmy shrine from a secondary way, one reserved for the clerics who were housed nearby. Of course, the two had no idea that this was the case, for they couldn't see the grand entrances on the other faces of the great block that was the temple building. A large vestibule with three passageway was the first thing they saw upon entering. To either hand, the reddish light common in the undercity was apparent, for the temple was filled with the strange globes. Ahead, the corridor glowed with a golden illumination that was unique to the place. "Straight on," Lita Gord hissed to the dark elf. "That light must come from their most precious place of veneration." The pair ran on down the passage, a 10-foot width of polished alabaster with precious gold inlaid in the mosaic tiles of its walls. Break. So here we're getting a little description of the temple, or the center point of the city out of mind here. We get a little description of the grand entrance, and that on a second level up, Gord and Lita are coming through what is an entrance for the clerics, and that the clerics have their housing nearby. So they're always in attendance on the temple. All right, I'm going to continue. It's page 266, paragraph 2. "Straight on, Lita," Gord hissed to the dark elf. Oh, I'm sorry. Paragraph 3. "Light is mysterious to them, I think. They must make this place so bright to awe the commoners, a reminder of the time when their ancestors dwelled upon the surface." Lita panted as they hurried forward. "It gives us a great advantage, for the pygmies will be nearly blind in such conditions." "And a drow?" "Most will be, but not I," Lita replied. "Eclavdra was supplied with the omered cusp that protect the eyes from radiation of most sorts, and I, as her physical duplicate, also wear a pair of them." Before they could converse further, the two came into a huge pillared hall. He looked out upon a curved end wall, column side aisles, and a wide central way. Down the middle of the four broad main aisles stretch lines of displays, as if the place was a museum. Perhaps it once had been such. Displays were encased in clear material, glass, crystal, or whatever. Lord could not tell. Along the way they came, the exhibits were of priestly nature, it seemed. They dashed past ancient books and even older-looking scrolls, carved chairs, displayed vestments, ornate reliquaries, and sacred offerings in altar pieces, and clerical paraphernalia of gold and silver. The central portion of the mighty chamber was domed in gold, and the floor beneath this dome was a disk of dark, polished onyx. Set around this circle was a rail of wood inlaid with gold and broken at only one spot. On the side from which they approached, outside the rail were curved benches of a size suitable for the pygmy folk. Perhaps 100 or so could be seated here. Naturally, the benches faced inward, so that the greatest of the albino's treasures could be venerated. From the apex of the dome, fully 40 feet above the onyx floor, hung a massive chain of dull greenish metal. About 2/3 of the way down from the roof on this upper chain was fastened a massive ring. Four slightly smaller chains radiated out beneath this ring, enclosing a globe of crystalline transparency. Each of these four lengths of greenish links was caught fast again below the sphere by another great ring, and this in turn was fastened to another stretch of thicker chain that extended down to the onyx floor, held fast by a massive staple of the same metal as itself. If I stretched, I think I could just about touch the lower ring, Lita said to the young thief. I have never seen anything quite so black, Gord said in wonderment, as he stared at the transparent globe. He referred to the small object set inside the crystal, a vaguely cone-shaped thing with three protruding parts that vaguely resembled horns. Right, so there is a description of the third part, the third key to the to Theridan's lock. And we have a good description here of the temple. And quite a place to loot if characters that could ever make their way in. You know, a lot of the things, of course, aren't going to be of the size like the vestments, and it shows that the first cases are of kind of a priestly sort of thing. Now, I'm surprised that only 100 of the pygmies could fit, as they're, you know, they're about halfling size, I'd guess, because Abmi describes them as shorter than he is. I should have noted that yesterday when he mentioned it, that here he's a foot taller than the pygmy Sul. Now, as they're fighting, it seems that the baboon-like creatures don't seem to be, there doesn't seem to be a presence of them, and instead, at this point, they've been encountering just the pygmy Sul themselves, and they seem to taking pretty big losses against the incursion of Abmi, Eclavdra, and Eclavdra, while Gord and Lita have managed to sneak around the outside of most of this fighting. I would think that this great central temple would hold more than room for 100 of the Sul pygmies, so I'm a little surprised by that, and I that is what was in Gygax's mind, but I would think it would be room for hundreds or maybe even like 1,000 or more. I'm just thinking of like big cathedrals or big temples here made for humans that would contain, you know, hundreds of people or even 1,000 or more people. And these pygmies, Sewell, should be, you know, they're about half the size or even less than a normal human. So, by size and weight, maybe a third or a quarter of the size. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 267, and it is the fifth paragraph from the end. Leda tugged at his arm to break his trance-like state. Don't stare at it. Don't look directly at it at all. That thing gives on to a part of the multiverse which is the opposite of what we know. It seems so black because it devours light. Don't touch it, for it will drain your life as it withers your flesh. How in the hopping hells do you expect me to touch it, girl? No one can get at it. You must, Gord, and stop calling me girl. I'm far older than you are. Gord slapped the dark elf on her round posterior, chuckling as he did so to break the tension of the situation. No, you aren't. You said yourself that you're only months old. I should call you child, not girl. Yes, my memories stretch back over centuries, so I am no girl. Stop this foolish behavior. Get moving. We have to lose that. We have to loose that globe, crack it somehow, and gain the final key while the pygmies are busy elsewhere. Well, you know, there's a comment here. Chris asked, did we get to mention of who cast the clone spell? And I'm pretty sure at the beginning that it was Vuron who did the clone spell of Eclavdr, but I don't know. That might just have been context or what I remembered from something else. I'm not sure it is actually mentioned who did the clone spell.
And then the reason I asked was because Eclavdr had a bracelet or something that made her eyes not be hurt. And clones don't always get all of the physical stuff that all the garments and magic items. They may or they may not, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, there's no reason, although that was such a helpful item in the desert, and Eclavdra is stating how much she was worried before when they were going through the Sea of Dust, and when they were in the tunnel, she was telling Gord that it might even kill her if they had to keep going over the top where it was so hot and bright and everything. And so I'm not surprised that Vuron, who was responsible for a lot of decking out, and this was his plan, I'm not surprised that he would give those cusps, you know, that cover Clavdra's eyes, that it would also give them to Leda. So, like I said, I know it's his plan, but I wasn't sure if they ever mentioned whether he actually was the one who cast the spell.
I was going to say that, like, it's around the time when she's probably, maybe a little past the time when, like, she definitely wants to kill Eclavdr, but I think she may go insane, too.
I mean, Leda has been changing her personality in the last couple of chapters, really. And Gord has been surprisingly submissive about it. And he's actually, you know, he's been a bit of a patronizing ass most of the time, Gord. Like, I'm not surprised that girl, I find it amusing that Gygax was aware of, you know, how annoying or offensive that continually calling her girl all the time. And back when Lita was more of herself, she'd always call him love or darling or something, and he'd call her girl. But the context was never quite in a loving pet name kind of thing. It was always, you know, always was seemed like a bit to take her down a notch. And I think Gygax even kind of puts the story where Gord, just recently, Gord kind of, he wants to one-up her when she's explaining about something. He wants to add a little stuff just to show that he knows more than she does. It's very funny because, you know, Gygax in this story is showing some, you know, like there's some awareness of how, you know, how Gord is acting. And yet at the same time, there seems to be this, it is also a natural part of Gygax, you know, I mean, from his generation and everything. So yeah, this business right here is a combination of both. I think, Lita becoming Eclavdra, and also Gord's normal, Gord's normal attitude toward things. So here he slaps her on the ass again, and that is, you know, not going to go well with Eclavdra, where Lita is a little more, a little more submissive. Although Lita's an interesting character because Gygax has been very poor in writing women. It's not surprising. It's very, she has been one of the, the strongest female character in the story so far. And there is these kind of tussles that go back and forth between Lita and Gord, of who, you know, Lita does, you know, she does push forward quite a bit, and she does, direct him, and, she is not like Evelie, you know, just screaming and falling behind most of the time. Lita is a much more powerful character.
Hopefully she doesn't turn out to be as treacherous as Evelie.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. I'm going to restart. It's page 268 and the second paragraph from the top. What the Dark Elf said made sense. There should have been dozens of guards and priests in the place, yet the temple was seemingly deserted, for now, anyway, and there was no telling when the battles going on outside would carry over to within this chamber. Gord glanced around to see if there was anything nearby that might help him in what he meant to do. His eye fell upon a nearby display case. It held a statue, a lifelike work that depicted a warrior of an ancient empire, arrayed for battle, and holding an oval-shaped shield and a surprisingly modern-looking sword. The weapon fairly radiated excellence of craftsmanship to the young adventurer. It was as long as the blade he held now, and shaped very much like it, yet there were differences that struck Gord as indicating that some great artisan had fashioned the weapon in the case. The blade was not as heavy and thick as the one he held, and the guard and quillions were far better. When he took a step and looked closer, Gord saw that the sword had a dish-shaped cutting edge and a rigid spine along its length, all in all an excellent tool. "There is my new weapon," he said with quiet determination. Lita's face contorted in anger. "Have you gone daft?" she scolded. "Use that vaunted dagger of yours to sever those chains. We must have the final key now." Ignoring the Dark Elf entirely, Gord strode up to the tall case of wood-framed glass and peered at the incredibly realistic statue of the Sul Knight therein. "Sorry, paragon of lost dreams of conquest. I have greater need for that blade than you do," he said. And with that, he smote the case with the sword he was carrying. Strips of wood snapped, and thick panes of glass shivered into fragments that chimed and tinkled as they split into slivers upon contact with the stone floor. At the same moment, a puff of smoke erupted within the sundered display. Thor jumped back to escape the foul-smelling emission, coughing and wiping away the tears that the stuff caused to stream from his eyes. What have you? Look out, Gord! Ida's warning was unnecessary, for Gord saw it too. There was a crunch of powdering glass as the statue of the Soul Knight, complete with sword in hand, leaped down upon the shards and flinders of the wrecked case. You seek this blade, sooty-haired subhuman. I shall give it to you. The warrior set upon Gord with a rush as he spoke the last sentence. The so-called statue was alive. Break. All right, so there's a comment here. The cuss came from Vuron. and then grab it, Gord. Do it. You know you want it. Now, what I find, this is, you know, here is the ancient Sul warrior. Now, I'm rather surprised that it's in a wooden glass, you know, enclosure with some kind of gas that is preserving him. And he's instantly animated. You know, this is supposed to be something that is, you know, what this man is preserved for 100 centuries, if not millennia. And he's in a glass and wood structure that Gord can break with his sword. Now, I know the Sul would have been very careful around it. Yes. All right, and then it's commented that it's strange that this statue speak common. And even if Gord understands Sul, to understand ancient Sul, now Gord is university educated, but to understand ancient Sul, that seems, again, very strange. So we have the fragility of this glass case that the man's been in for, you know, 1,000 years, and then suddenly, it's kind of like Star Trek or Stargate. I remember when Stargate began, they were fooling around with the idea that these people would speak their own language, and they wouldn't be able to communicate, and then that was such a pain in the ass that they, you know, they were like, there's no way we can do this, so everybody suddenly, you know, everybody understood each other. And I think they ended up explaining it as a function of the transport thing that they did, that it also had like a universal translator to it, because it is just very annoying. So Gygax has provided the universal translator. So somehow this it's commented that it's useful, but clunky, and it is very clunky, because it immediately strikes you, how can they understand each other? And I would have been perfectly fine. I don't think they really needed to. And I think it would have been very fine. Now, what I think would have been interesting is if they're talking, trying to talk to him, and say, Leda casts a spell that translates it. And at first, it's coming out as ancient Sul. You know, they don't understand it, but I don't think Gygax was into making up a language just for a few words here. All right. I am going to restart. It's page 269 and the fourth paragraph down from the top. The ancient knight was clad in armor of antique design, but the metal was as good as, or even better than that of any cavalier who boasted of the latest plate today. He held a shield of good metal, too. All that plus a sword made him more than a match for the young thief, even though Gord wore a shirt of elfin chainmail and could use his enchanted dagger in addition to the unimpressive longsword. Gord met the warrior's rush, avoided his opening shield smash, and parried an overhand stroke of the sword. The duel was on then, but the third time their weapons made contact, Gord's steel broke under the force of the blonde knight's blow. At that, the young adventurer hurled the remnant of the old sword at the laughing Sewell. As the knight jerked his shield up to ward off the missile, Ward did a back somersault, followed by several rolls, and was clear of danger for a moment. "Tumbler's antics won't save you, Niggling," the tall man said, as he strode forward to attack again. At that pass, Lita sprang into the conflict. Her sudden rush surprised the haughty fellow. The dark elf's flashing scimitar nearly went home. As it was, the knight barely had time to try to parry the vicious cut, while attempting to duck away. At the same time, he succeeded only partially, for the tip of the curved blade drew a red line across his cheek. "Face a truly sooty foe, then, you yapping human curls," she snarled. Her tone and posture demonstrated that Lita was very ready to fight this ancient minion of the Empire of Sewell to the death. Infuriated at the little wound, the challenge, and the fact that not only was this a female, but a black-skinned non-human one at that, the knight roared some ancient oath and unleashed a storm of steel upon the drow. His attack was so swift and brutal that Lita had all she could manage to survive, blocking, parrying, and retreating without getting in another blow of her own. She kept the knight busy, and that was all that was needed. In one instant, Lita saw Gord move across her field of vision with unhuman swiftness, springing from behind the knight's left flank with his dagger sweeping in a sideways arc. Momentary distraction almost cost Lita her life, for at that very moment the Sewell warrior planted his feet and sent a downward cut at her. She brought her scimitar up a split second too late. By then the knight stroke had gathered sufficient momentum. His sword was deflected, but not before it had knocked Lita's weapon from her numbed hand and drove her to her knees with its force. Laughing in anticipation, the fair-skinned knight drew back his arm to sink the sword point first into the dark elf's breast. His peal of laughter ended in a high-pitched howl of anguish. Ward yanked the long-bladed dagger from where it had sunk through the knight's armor and into the flesh of his bicep. The young adventurer twisted the weapon as he pulled it free, mocking the laughter that the knight had voiced just an instant before. "Ha ha ha, now you think such work is mirthful." The knight whirled and swung a crossbody cut at him, but Gord was too quick, ducked under the blow, dived into the man's legs, and sent the knight sprawling. Again Gord's dagger struck, and again its magically sharp point penetrated metal and flesh, this time that of the haughty Sewell warrior's left thigh. "Hey, I cry truce," the knight said as he tried desperately to regain his feet. Lita kicked at the arm he was using to lever himself up in such a way as to maintain his shield between himself and Gord. Boot knocked the arm so that it bent. Again the knight sprawled, and this time it was worse. The sword spun from his grasp when Lita's foot impacted against his arm. "I'll show you a truce, pig," she growled as she reached for her scimitar. "Wait, Lita," said Gord quickly. "Perhaps this revivification of the ancients can help us." "Don't be foolish," she shot back as she picked up her sword and advanced on the near helpless man. "This one is like a scorpion. We must kill him." "Listen to me, foreigner," the knight pleaded, addressing the more merciful of the pair. "I honorably ask for quarter now, not truce. I offer, by proof of my surrender, the sword you coveted. Take my blade, and this fine armor too, as is your right, but spare my life." "Take." "All right. Yes, he has the familiar Sioux attitude," Chris mentions. Now, the only thing is, again, he is cookie cutter evil. It's just very unfortunate that Gygax did this continuous run of villains that, you know, once, you know, that all have these same reactions. This is, now, he may have intended this, because this goes all the way back to the Sewell monk, the Scarlet Brotherhood monk at the beginning of Artifact of Evil. And again, this ancient Sewell he actually, you just kind of wonder after this. I mean, it's not that Leda and Gord fought him at the same time. Leda gave Gord a bit of a distraction, but it's kind of like why Gord had any trouble with him in the first place when he brings him down so easily after he, you know, fights Leda and knocks her to the ground, that suddenly now Gord gets a surprise shot at him. But pretty much after that, Gord has his own way in fighting this knight and doesn't seem to be having any problems. There is, again, he immediately turns kind of craven. So it's very strange that, you know, this is exactly the way people are acting. You know, yes, Chris says groveling seems to be a soul trait that spans eons. And yeah, it's how, you know, it's just how much I would rather have seen a variety of characteristics of the evil characters rather than pretty much every one of them acting in the same way. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 271, and it is the second paragraph from the end. One long stride put Gord between the half-prone man and the advancing Dark Elf. "Leda, please get a sword and bring it to me," Gord said mildly. She hesitated, then with a look of disgust at the young man, shrugged her shoulders and turned to do his bidding, keeping one eye on the enemy all the while. "As for you, warrior from the past," Gord continued, "don't you know that your empire and all like you are gone? The land above, and the bones of all your fellows, too, blow as dust over a desert which has swallowed up your vaunted realm. Fah, just because you two forced my surrender does not mean I am deranged. Lies will not serve you at all. Spare me now, and when my companions, come to slay you, I will speak on your behalf. Your sword are useful in our auxiliary bands. Service might even earn you the right of citizenship." A break. Now, all right. That is a very revealing comment. That at his time, that they had auxiliary warriors of non-Sewell, and that they could even earn citizenship. I don't know. I mean, it depends on what they mean by citizenship. And obviously, you know, we see that, and it sounds like it's a Roman federati. And it really does seem strange that their culture would allow, they're so... you know, they've got such a strong, you know, racial and racist tendency that it just seems strange that they would allow non-Sewell to ever be citizens unless citizenship doesn't have the same meaning. I mean, Romans allowed non-Romans to be citizens. And, you know, it was a very, very powerful thing to be as a Roman citizen. At different times later in their history, at the end of the Republic and during the Empire, it was a very powerful thing to be a Roman citizen. And you could imagine it would have been a very powerful thing to be a Sewell citizen of the Sul Imperium. So I'm a little surprised about that. All right. And Chris is putting up the imprisonment spell. And that sounds quite like that's a level 9 spell. And when an imprisonment spell is cast, the victim touched is entombed in a state of suspended animation in a small sphere below the surface. The victim remains there unless a reverse of the spell. And it does sound like there's some kind of imprisonment spell put on this knight. Now, you have to ask, too, he's completely unaware of that he was put in suspended animation. You have to wonder why. You know, why at the time, 1,000 years ago or so, did he get thrown into suspended animation in the first place?
It doesn't seem like he knows what's going on currently.
Oh, no. And I mean, I found that kind of ridiculous for Gord to ask, don't you know? Of course he doesn't know his empire's gone. That seems, you know, maybe he would have been imprisoned after the colorless fire. But, there's no way any of them could know when he was imprisoned. But, unfortunately, I'm kind of acting on material I do know. But he does seem to be a pre-cataclysm Sul. Yes, and maybe he's just a night watchman and not really a night, night as such. But, all right. I am going to restart. It's page 272 and the second paragraph down from the top. Your words make no sense, Gord said without anger. What do you know about the sphere suspended yonder? Sul stood up and looked where Gord pointed. Though they have encased the cone of the Magi in Rezokist. But what of Utho. All right, break. So, in this one little sentence, this is one of the reasons why, you know, I love the Gygax books. One little sentence, and we have, all right, the third artifact, the third key the artifact of evil, is called the Cone of the Magi. The crystal around it, this ancient Sul is calling Rezokist. And so he knew of the substance. He knew of the artifact, the key. And obviously they knew before cataclysm, they had the artifact. And then there is something or someone called U-A-T-T-H-O, Utho. And again, just no reference, whatever. I don't know if it's a person or a thing or a group. All right, I'm going to continue. Page 272, fourth paragraph down. Never mind, said Gord, not knowing how else to respond to this cryptic question. You're on your parole, so stand quietly and do nothing until I say otherwise, he instructed the bemused warrior. Then Leda was beside him, handing him his newly won sword, and Gord smiled as he held it and felt its balance. Thanks, love, he said to her. He walked over to one of the benches surrounding the globe and laid the sword there for safekeeping. I'll see about the final key now. Then we can be away. My time was all the Dark Elf replied. She took up a post where she could guard the Sul warrior, as well as get a good view of the four wings of the temple, watching lest some unexpected arrival should take them unawares. A little more than a bowshot distance from the temple, Eclavdra, high priest and champion of the demon Gratz, drained the last trace of energy from a wailing albino spellbinder. The little man had failed to avoid the kiss of her demon-wrought staff, and the leering visages that were carved along its length seemed to gloat as the thing sucked the pale midget's life from its trembling body. Eclavdra and her guards, four drow males, had faced a great many of these same little men. The members of her escort, however, were skilled not only with weapons, but also with magic. All who dared oppose their advance had died. She did not know, of course, that the albino force had been divided. Her contempt for the pygmies was great, and Eclavdra credited herself and her henchmen with being so puissant as to be able to virtually walk over such puny opponents. Break. I mean, it is very interesting that they're equating size, physical size, with power in a world where we have halflings, dwarves, gnomes, and other small creatures, small people, demi-humans, that are, you know, incredibly powerful, and that we also have a world filled with giants and giant monsters, including towering dragons and such, which characters of sufficient power face. And so it seems to me that Gygax, he seems to be equating the size of these Sul with a certain lack of power, and it just doesn't match up with the AD&D setting. Your physical self, especially for magic, even warriors. If you're a skilled warrior, then everybody around these Sul are attacking are simply giant sized. I mean, it's not like, you know, like we don't have the humans go up against giants. So I find it strange that Gygax keeps equating the shrunken size of the Sul with their power, especially magicians and spellcasters. But even warriors, it really shouldn't matter the size. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 273 and the second paragraph down from the top. "The temple we seek is just ahead," Chosen of Gratst, one of the males, said to her. Just then there was a blue flash inside the big building the male was pointing toward. "What was that?" Eclavdra demanded of the smaller drow. "Some energy discharge. Of what sort, I cannot say." "No matter," Eclavdra told the woolly-haired male. "Gather up your fellows and precede me. Will any oppose you? I will cover your advance." "There are savage bands of wild-looking humans roaming around these streets, great one. Perhaps I should remain behind with you, in case one of these groups should attack." That triggered something in Eclavdra's mind. While she hated to think that their assault had been aided by such a lowly event, the situation did amuse her. "Nonsense, underling. Stupid albinos are beset with a revolt of their slaves, and just at the time we came to their filthy little hive to take what is rightfully ours. Obviously, this is the work of the Dark Lord of the Abyss. He smiles on us and gives us his aid. That moving dolt. I want the Theopart now." And here, Eclavdra states something that I was talking about yesterday, and it's just that I don't understand, you know, I mean, why Gygax does some of these things. It just seems a very poor choice to have Gord, Abmi, and Eclavdra come to the city at exactly the same time. I mean, previously, Eclavdra is speeding toward the plateau. We never learn anything more about it. I would love to have heard what was on the plateau. Was it the city covered in a stone things projecting out of the dust? I mean, is the city buried in dust? Is it sunk into the plateau? Why is the plateau in existence when the colorless fire, Gygax says, burnt down the mountains and the hills? Did the original spell cover the whole plateau? Did it cover the whole city? We have Leda telling us that this is only the center of the old city. And it's kind of like, well, why should she know? And then Ami is supposedly struggling along in his wind cruiser. Now, Gordon Leda had to walk the whole distance. At least it wasn't on the surface, on that slow paced. But they had to walk the whole distance through these tunnels. So they're walking several hundred miles. Eclavdra is flying along. She's going along at 20 or 30 miles an hour in that fish thing. And then finally at like 50 or more miles an hour when they want to get to the plateau. Abmi is going, I don't know how fast, on the wind cruiser. They all have to start at different times to end up the city at the same time, and it just seems that is just terrible storytelling. It is just like Eclavdra is saying, who aided this fate? And yet at the same time, they have never had this kind of showing that their actions are being controlled by fate in such a way, and to leave them with a result that you have Abmi, Eclavdra, Gordon, Leda in the city, at the temple, at the very same time. And that is very much, you know, I think that is very poor storytelling on Gygax's part. All right. I'm going to restart. It's page 273 in the final paragraph. Bowing his cotton white head, the male hurried away to gather his comrades and obey Eclavdra's command, cursing her mentally as he went. Were it not for the mighty black demon who favored her, he would be able to dispose of the high priestess unaided. How dare such a nothing order him around? No matter, he would have the other three take his instructions, and he would cover their assault upon the temple. If any of them were to survive, it would be him. Break. Now, it would be interesting if they had given this guy some kind of name. You know, he doesn't want to be just one of the red shirts here, but it's a bad sign when Gygax hasn't bothered to name him. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 274. A first paragraph. It took some time, but the dagger did its job, and the lower chain fell to the polished Ankh floor with a loud clatter. Ford grabbed the bit of chain that dangled from the bottom of the now free-swinging globe, and was about to clamber up the thing when he heard a choking cry from behind. What? He turned, and there was Leda, red-smeared scimitar in hand, the knight of the ancient empire lying at her feet in a spreading pool of blood. Flaming hells, what have you done? The sneaky bastard was preparing to steal up behind you, Gord, ready to kill you when your back was turned, Leda replied with an icy tone. Then she used her toe to roll the man over. As his corpse flopped onto its back, the dagger he had gripped, dagger held gripped in his dead fingers was exposed. As I told you, his kind are scorpions. Angry but much abashed, Gord returned to his work. The little spring he was upon the strange globe, averting his gaze from what the glassy ball contained. It swung like a pendulum, but that didn't bother him in the least. In a moment, Gord was on top of the globe, climbing up the long chain, a little ways only. Then, holding fast with his left hand, the young thief began cutting the greenish metal of the heavy link just below the one he gripped. The enchanted blade of his dagger bit into the weird metal, but only so as to make the dull greenish cast a little brighter. It was not surprising to him. This was the same as had occurred when he had attacked the lower finding of the globe. Several more such slashes and chops, however, made the metal gleam still more brightly as the cut widened and deepened. "Where below?" he called softly to Lita. "I'm watching you, child. Stop playing around and bring that thing down." Gritting his teeth in frustration, Ward gripped the dagger and prepared to smite the chain exceptionally hard. Then he heard shouts and clanging nearby. "Damn," Lita cried. "Our foes are coming, Gord. Stop this delaying and get the Theopart down." With a grunt of effort, Gord brought his long-bladed dagger's edge against the bright spot on the link. Force and the keen edge were sufficient. Strange green-hued metal split apart at the point of impact. The broken link groaned as its form stretched and bent under the weight of the chain-bound sphere it held. Then it gave, suddenly, and the ball of transparent substance fell to the stone beneath, making the domed temple boom and clang with the force of its impact. The rail smashed and benches broke where it hit. That thing was heavy. Ward started to shout with glee as the chain and wrapped globe bounced and rolled across the temple floor. His gaze followed it as it weaved this way and that. Then the young man's eyes widened and his delight was cut short. The careening sphere's course took it toward the wing to his left. Although Gord didn't know it, this was the northern entrance to the place, and one that had just been entered by another group of invaders. Globe veered and turned as it rolled unevenly on the chains, finally coming to stop at the feet of a small figure, not much taller than the ball of translucent material itself, had just stepped into the chamber. It was an armored little fellow with vast shoulders and huge beard, a dwarf with a huge hammer in his left hand, and a blood-stained military pick in his right. Ward recognized him at once and spat his name under his breath as if it were a curse. "Rob me, you dirty toad, all." The dwarf did not hear the remark, but even if he had, he could not have scowled any more blackly as he looked up at Gord, figuring him to be one of Eclavdra's minions. He did not hesitate in issuing an order to kill. "Oh, bring down that monkey," he commanded, pointing toward Gord as he spoke. Lita took advantage of the moment to run as fast as she could back into the corridor she and Gord had used to get into the place. Her companion was in a bad spot. She saw no way she could either help him or take on both the dwarf and his spell worker at the same time. She had no spells she could put to good use at the moment. And in her haste, she forgot entirely about the wand she was carrying in the pocket of the cloak she wore beneath her robe. So she fled for a short distance until she was out of sight of Gord and the dwarf, and then she remembered the ring. "Yes, Lord," the wizard replied, already holding the components he needed to cast his spell. Gord had a scant few seconds to form and execute a plan. He dared not to try leaping down hastily, or an uncontrolled drop from his height might injure him, or at least hinder his mobility. The safer course was to remain hanging from the chain, at least for the time being, where he would have distance on his side. He tried to start his body swinging on the end of the chain, so as to present a tougher target, but he did not have time to build up much momentum before a bolt of crackling energy shot from the spellcaster's fingertips. Alright, so we're back into this little combat scene, and, you know, very, very fortuitous. And there is Gord, dangling on the chain on the cover. I'd almost forgotten this. There he is, knife in hand, dangling on the chain, and I guess that's Bolt there, getting ready to cast his lightning bolt, his namesake. Now, Gygax seems to have forgotten or purposely, you know, left out. Gord is a thief acrobat. One of the benefits should be that he can drop about 30 feet down without injury. And I don't know how high up they have him. The ceiling of this chamber was only 40 feet up. So I don't think it should be any problem for Gord to drop to the floor. But Gygax doesn't want him to. You know, he wants this action scene where there is... So we got a little picture on the cover, too, of what the inside of the temple of the Theopart is here in the City Out of Mind. And rather than a pygmy soul that appears to be a white-haired bolt there, the bolt, the wizard. All right. I'm going to restart page 276 and the second paragraph to the end. Let me watch with glee as the force of the spell crossed the distance between Bolt and the suspended figure faster than the eye could follow. A purplish-blue flash of electricity that hit the thick metal chain and made an eerie, fiery light play up and down its length. As the man who had grasped the chain dropping off just as the lightning hit, no matter, it was too late. An aura of light surrounded the falling form. And the fellow fell like a stone, hitting the floor feet first, and then collapsing with a dull plop. The licked victim lay burned and unmoving. "That one will not trouble me now," Obmi said with a cruel smile. "I congratulate you, Bolt. It is fortunate for you that you succeeded." The ugly dwarf was suddenly in an exceptionally good mood, since he had vanquished his opponent and the object of his quest lay literally at his feet. "Many thanks, great dwarf. I'm here to serve capably, not misperform," the wizard responded ingratiatingly. "Very well," said Ma'abi in a magnanimous tone. "In light of what you have accomplished since, I will overlook the fact that you misperformed when you supposedly killed Eclavdra and her party those many weeks ago. I know not who you victimized that time, but I do know that it was the drow bitch herself who disappeared down that hallway a minute ago." The dwarf turned to a pair of the Yoli warriors who stood behind him. "Go find her, but do not kill her. Bring her to me and I will reward you well." Two nomads bowed hurriedly and sped away. Break. This is the end of chapter 17, page 277. As Chris notes here, if Gord is at level 18, he has an 80% chance of avoiding damage from a 40-foot fall. But maybe I'm wrong, or maybe this is a different chart. I thought there was a 30% chance that there was a that he took no damage from a 30-foot fall, but I'm not sure.
I think it's an 80% chance, and the 30-foot fall. Where is it on the chart? 30-foot. If he's level 14, yeah. If he's level 15, he takes no damage from a 30-foot fall.
All right. So we know he's up there and everything.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, I bet he's 15 at least.
Oh, God, yeah. Now, one of the things I find interesting here, Gygax has again brought up something that's very strange. He did this, done this before. All right. We know where Gord was, going back to where he discovers Leda. All right. We know that that party comes down, and he's with the Aradon, and they've taken Gord capture, and they're heading to Lake Carnoush to sell him at the slave market. All right? Now, then they know that there's this party of Yoli with a Eclavdra coming. Now, there's no mention of Bolt. There's no mention of some out. Now, the other thing is, Obmi is all the way back in La Pala. He's not even in Crestor or Gastor or anything. He's in La Pala. And Bolt somehow, he's a magician, maybe he flew. You know, we're talking about flying. Somehow, Bolt joins the party to attack Cladra. And I mean, it's like there's no mention of him with the Aradon. I don't know how he would have found the Aradon. There's no mention of a magical attack. It's just the Aradon are closing in, you know, and so stupidly that they form this skirmish line around them, circling the Yoli and Ecclavdra, and then Gord, who has freed himself, comes and starts killing them one by one and kills, including Yahud, the leader of the Aradon. All right. So again, Abmi is saying that Bolt was there, and Bolt said he killed Ecclavdra. And it's funny, because Abmi is correct. Even though this is Leda, everyone thinks she's Ecclavdra, and he failed to kill Leda Ecclavdra, so Abmi's actually right. That when did misperform, he did tell Abmi he killed Ecclavdra, and yet Leda survived, so he didn't. So I find that, you know, very amusing right there, and that Abmi is actually right. I was thinking, Abmi's not fair, but you know, that's not right. And then it is. He did not kill Leda, so he did not kill Ecclavdra, you know, and he just reported that to Abmi that he did. I don't understand why these characters, you want to link up with Abmi, you know. I mean, he's always threatening to kill them, and he's always killing his underlings. You know, why would any of these people stay with him? I mean, it is ridiculous, because he has unfailingly killed underlings all and sent them to slaughter all through these books since he was shown in Artifact of Evil. All right, 7:02, and gonna close up for the night here. I think this is a good point to stop. We're actually stopping at the end of chapter 17, so we're gonna be starting on Wednesday with chapter 18, and